22 at the break, am I right?
Yes.
Yeah? After all his journeyings and efforts, King Asvapati has experienced a last and mightiest transformation of his consciousness and his nature, which has allowed him to enter into the house of the Spirit. And there's an experience of waiting. He has set off with a particular aspiration to find the power that would be able to change life on earth into a diviner state. That has been the object of all his journeys. And he feels he has found that power in the Supreme Divine Mother, but he hasn't yet been able to ask her his question. But I suppose he feels that she knows what his question is, what his aspiration is. So there's a waiting. It's as if the whole universal force, the creative force which is supporting all the movements of the universe, is waiting silently for the veiled transcendence ultimate decree, from the Supreme, some final decree must come which would allow that change to happen. I think that is what Asvapati is waiting for. So that is where we will see what happens next. Manoha, you'll start. Anything to ask?
Yeah. Perhaps that this is one of the best passages I've ever read.
Yeah.
The downward look is himself looking inside.
No, I think it is the Supreme Mother looking down. The transcendent, we can say. The Supreme Being is both the witness and the force united, the Supreme Being. And the ultimate decree has to come from there. And now that Supreme Being is looking down, it's as if a vast ocean is exploring what is there in the depths. No? And it's all connected. It spreads out from a core where the oneness is. It spreads out, and this love, everything is joined. Asvapati feels joined to all the multitudes, all the beings in the manifestation. Yes, Don?
No, it's just a very beautiful sentence to go along with what Manoharji said. Existence found its truth on oneness.
Yes. Yes. So in a way, this is an ultimate experience, no? Where we feel that each single one of us, all the beings, became the self and space of all. Everyone and everything is connected in that oneness, and that gives meaning to existence. So all the world rhythms, the rhythms of the universe, it's like the throbbing of one heart, one soul. So the sense experiences, become a flame discovery of God, feeling the wonder of the embrace divine here in the universe. All mind is connected. It's like a wonderful musical instrument, and each of us is a string playing a different note, while the universe is being played on this many strings. All life a song of many meeting lives. There are many, many worlds, but there's only one self to all these worlds, connecting everything in the universe and the manifestation. Marvelous experience. But that's not the end, that's the beginning of something. Something is about to happen. Sorry? Well, that's an image that Sri Aurobindo gives for this downward look. It must be the Supreme Being looking down, and that is an ocean of oneness. And with that look, it is exploring all the depths and all the corners and all the bits of itself, of its manifest itself.
And its core?
The core is the heart, the center. So first the oneness is there, contained, concentrated in a center of oneness. It widens and joins everything together. Yeah, if what we feel, every feeling that we have, gives us a contact with God, it's so intense. It's like a flame of difficult to bear for our present state. Shall we go on? Margaret, you would read.
This knowledge now was made.
Knowledge, a realization of the oneness. But he says that knowledge becomes the seed of a universe, of a cosmos.
But it needed not a sheath of the universe.
Yes. It seems as if our cosmos, the universe we live in, needs this covering of ignorance. But that seed of the new cosmos is protected in the light, in the full light of consciousness. It doesn't need that protective covering of ignorance. It's a different kind of cosmos from the cosmos that we know. You may ask, why would we need a sheath of ignorance? But I think we won't go into all those philosophical questions just now. We'll just stick to the text.
But it's an interesting question.
Yeah. I'm sure we will, when we're reading Life Divine, we will come to this question and this answer.
I think to approach the divine, we have to cross the veil of darkness and veil of light.
Yes.
Is something which is covered of light?
I think we have to take these two sentences together. This is the introduction. Now the canto is called The House of the Spirit and the New Creation. We've seen Asvapati in the House of the Spirit. Now he is going to experience the New Creation. And it grows out of this downward look. And this widening sense of the oneness of everything. Out of that knowledge comes the seed of a new creation, of a cosmos. And out of all that amazing experience, the trance of that tremendous clasp, that embrace of oneness, from the throbbings of that single heart, the heart beats of one soul, it said, no? And from that naked spirit's victory, that at least in Asvapati there has been a victory of the naked spirit, no? He has been able to experience that supreme realization. So out of all that, now he sees, perhaps he only sees the possibility, but it's described very, very concretely, of a new creation that is not cased in ignorance. And that's what gets described in the next two sections, this one that we're reading and the next one. Yes, Margaret.
The important thing is a case in the safety of the mind. It also comes before the bliss, the light, the power, flame, weight, love, called all into soul, immense embrace. That is the space where we are.
The new creation can come. Yes.
And it is here also the symbol of the Matamandir, where the light comes down. And in the retreat, Pato also showed the picture of Chantak Lal. He gave a talk in the United States, and one photograph got a whole ray of light from above on the picture with Chantak Lal. So it is a there's this new
knowledge, I think, and the new creation can come forward in the mind. Yes. So, we get the description of this new and marvelous creation. Patricia, if you like, you can read at line 220. Sorry? It means they all experienced one divine joy, which maybe expressed itself in many different ways, one state of divine delight. What are the different aspects of a universe? He starts with the infinitudes. There's a formless aspect, a limitless, boundless aspect to a universe. So these are all powers or expressions of the Supreme. They are flowing out infinitely, laughing. They are full of an unmeasured happiness, and they are all united. They are living their innumerable unity. There are so many that they can't be counted. They're incalculable, these infinite possibilities. And some of these possibilities get expressed in worlds. Worlds where being, the possibilities of existence, are unbound, free, wide. But they give form. In these worlds, there are forms. They create bodies. We can't imagine those bodies. They are unthinkable. They are bodies which express and contain the egoless self. Our problem is this sense of separation, that we are all in separate bodies, focuses us on our separate individuality. But there can be individual forms, individual beings and personalities that are all expressions of egoless self, different individual expressions, but not separate. And then there are these beatific, blissful energies in a state of rapture, of delight, which connect the outflowing of time, which is part of the formation of a universe. They connect it to the timeless state. Timelessness and time are experienced as poles of one single joy that can be experienced in time as well as beyond time. And there's a perception of white vasts. White always suggests purity, but also integrality, because all the colors go to make up white light. So it's the typical color of the spirit. There, everything is contained in everything. All is wrapped, embraced in all. So in this new and marvelous creation, there are no contraries. That's another of our problems, the dualities, that we can't experience one thing without knowing its opposite. And there are no sundered parts, no parts that have been cut away from each other, separated. To sunder something is to separate it. So all these beings and, yes, let's call them all beings, all these individualities are joined to all the others, linked by spiritual links, and they are all connected, bound indissolubly. They cannot be separated from the One. Each of them is unique, but it also feels itself living in all those other unique lives. And by being aware of those other lives, following out, these are all tones or notes of the infinite. Each one can recognize in himself the whole universe as part of his own being. It reminds us of the image Sri Aurobindo uses of the honeycomb, which I've often mentioned, that the end of it all, the fulfillment, will be like a honeycomb packed full of honey, of delight, in which the honeycomb itself is aware of all the delight of all the separate drops of honey, and each drop of honey experiences its own delight, but also the delight of all the others. This is another expression of that experience. So from a mental point of view, we can ask, how can infinity have a center? But there's an experience. Asvapati has had that experience of being a center, not the center, but a center of infinity. So this is a kind of way of experiencing one individuality as a center of that whirl of the infinite whole. So if that reaches its highest, most intense point, as well as its ultimate possible expansion, it can feel the divinity of its own individual self-bliss repeated in its numberless other selves, all the other beings, its numberless other selves. Murugan, maybe you would ask Suresh to ask those people to go and do their talking somewhere else. Yeah, I don't know exactly where it is. It's a lady on the telephone. Well, she should. If she can go and do it somewhere else, we would be able to concentrate more easily. Perhaps this splendid center is Asvapati's own self-experience at this time.
Everything that we've been living here is his own experience.
Yes, this is what he's experiencing. Yeah. So that center is never tired of including in its scope all these different persons and figures through which the impersonal expresses itself. And it goes on doing that endlessly. I like this image of the recurring decimal, that it goes on and on and on and on.
What is a recurring decimal?
What is a recur? The figure pi.
Yeah.
Yeah. So pi, if you express it in decimal numbers, it is infinite. It's an infinite repetition of a sequence. And that's called a recurring decimal. So you give the sequence once, and you put a dot over the top of the last number, and that shows that it goes on repeating and repeating and repeating.
What, like 1/3 decimal?
1/3 also is infinite. Huh? Decimal, a recurring decimal. But this multiplication is rapturous, it's delightful, this endless multiplication of delight, infinite delight. So none was apart, none lived for himself alone. Each lived for God in him and God in all. Each soulness, each aloneness or individuality inexpressibly held the whole. This would be the true experience of human unity. Anything else that we call by that name is just a hopeful simulacrum or something. No. This is the real thing, where each lives for God in him and God in all. Amit, would you like to read?
Their oneness was not tied to one tone. It showed a thousand aspects of itself. Its calm, immutable stability, upborne on a chargeless,
changeless, our mind tends to equate oneness, unity, with uniformity. We think it means that everybody has to be the same and feel the same and share the same ideas. But here he says oneness was not tied to monotone, to just one color. That oneness can show a thousand, a million, an infinity of different aspects of itself. Yes, yeah, that is what we're trying to fulfill, no? To have this feeling of oneness through all the diversity. It's very difficult. Actually, in our present state, we can't do it. It's only if we have discovered this oneness in ourselves that we'll be able to feel it in everybody else. The calm, immutable stability of that oneness supports on this changeless ground that is forever safe. The play, the plan and the play of immense world forces, they are all supported on that oneness. The world forces have their own free play, but they are compelled to a spontaneous servitude. They have to obey that oneness, but they spontaneously obey it because it's their own true essence and self. So when we look at the play of world forces, they may seem to be reckless, careless, even dangerous, but it's all the subtle plan of a dance of immense world forces in their play, their interplay of relationships and effects. That oneness made all persons fractions of the unique. Each feels itself a portion, a small portion of the one, of the soul, and yet all these individualities are in fact beings, secret integers. Each of them is really carrying in itself the whole of the oneness. It's one of the mysteries that Sri Aurobindo explains in The Life Divine. We may feel that each of us is a little part of the whole, but he says that's the illusion of our mind. Actually, within each part, each tiny part, whatever it is, in every subatomic particle, Satchidananda is present as a whole in all its existence, all its consciousness, all its force, all its bliss is ever present everywhere. So in this new and marvelous creation that is conscious, that is aware, that is experienced, So there's still all the interplay of difference and relationship, but it's on a completely different base, on the basis of the awareness of the oneness and the delight of the oneness. Norman, you'll read.
All struggle was turned to a sweet strife of love in the harmonized circle of a sure embrace. Identity's reconciling happiness gave a rich security to difference. On a meeting line of hazardous extremes, the game of games was played to its breaking point, where through self-finding by divine self-loss, there leaps out unity's supreme delight, whose blissful undivided sweetness feels a communality of the absolute.
Thank you. About Oroville, because Oroville is meant to move in this direction. No? This is, and somehow that dream is coded deep inside all of us. We recognize that that's how things should be. But we don't always realize the implications of it. We think that, oh, then everything will be harmony and no. But no, all the extremes of difference are there. I feel very grateful to Celestine for pointing out to me about 20 years ago. She said, if we were really experiencing human unity, we could quarrel. We wouldn't be afraid of representing our point of view that... But of course we should be able to do it in a loving way that doesn't cause suffering. So something like that is expressed in this. And we've read also in The Life Divine that this strife, now at our present state of division, it's a necessary thing. But it should become something like a sport where, you know, two tennis players really try to beat each other, but they can at the same time be very good friends, or off the court they can be very good friends. So the wrestling, you know, each is trying to be stronger and to prevail, but it doesn't mean a denial of the value of the other person. And eventually he said it should go even beyond that wrestle. It should become the embrace of love, where there's a joyful interchange of difference. But because we don't really experience that kind of divine love, then we also but anyway, that's perhaps where it comes closest. Know, where the differences can be joyfully shared.
I remember the mother, she was playing tennis. It was part of the discipline. Where waiting for a message for her, she gave it through the tennis player. She was tennis. It's very interesting what you said, because she was embracing everything.
Yes. So this is a game of relationships, it's a play. So this, on a meeting line of hazardous extremes, where extremes which really may seem to be dangerous, no? Where they meet, this game of game gets played to its breaking point, to the point where there's self-finding, self-discovery through divine self-loss when we identify ourselves completely with the other and experience the oneness.
When I was in Germany, I discovered something new. It was that a lot of people playing, also conscious people, playing games together. And they are beautiful games together. And in this game, you can bring out all what you're doing. You can play out the difference. And when you get beaten up, also, then I found it quite interesting that so many people are playing this. Yeah, and very beautiful games came up there.
Thank you.
Sit together and to play out in games difference and meet spontaneous reaction of the other.
Does the word ultimate relate to hazardous extremes?
Sorry, I've lost ultimate. Where is it?
It's not there.
Oh. Well, there are extremes of duality, mm-hmm. No, of hot and cold, or all kinds of differences. They have their extremes. They are like perhaps you can say the ultimate point of a range of possibilities. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this, but he says those extremes have to meet somewhere. There's a line where the extremes meet. So that's the line where there's this playing out to the moment of identification.
I'm confused about when one enters into a tennis match or that where does competitive begin and end? Because if one plays the best they know how, but they know at the end that they could have done better.
So next time they will try to do better.
Right.
And that's what we find, that, for example, artists like Picasso and Matisse, in a way we can say each of them was competing. They wanted to be the best, but actually each of them wanted to be the best in his own line. And then he could appreciate the excellence of the other one. Really excellent people appreciate each other. Because they need the when Picasso died, or it's the other way around, when Matisse died, that Picasso said, "Oh, who can I paint for? You know? Who can I paint for now?" You know?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you can see that Federer and Nadal and Djokovic and these people and the young people coming up, it does them good to have somebody that they can measure themselves against, and that stimulates them. It's called emulation. I think Mother has used this word in the dream. Oh, she said, this is how the relationships would be, of emulation, everybody trying to do better in the service of the divine. That's how we should be living, really.
But I wonder if these two lines apply to a real transformation also. The thought that came to me was the Chinese government and the Hong Kongers. There that you have a hazardous game going on. But it's going to go to its breaking point. So the next line says, by through self-finding, by divine self-loss.
Well, this is speaking.
You have to be pushed to a point where somebody fails in their way, and then another new line of thinking conquers.
That's true of our world. That's what he says. In our world, strife is necessary, in order to somehow work out a truer solution. And it can be very painful, and the truer solution doesn't always immediately emerge. Here he's speaking about where there's a creation, where there's a conscious basis of oneness, then the experience is much more delightful, less painful. Beyond all preferences and limitations, there is a way that all can meet. No? It is in the aspiration to serve the divine purpose, to serve the divine will. We could resolve all our difficulties on that basis if we were all really sincere and working on our egos. But the trouble is, it's just at that point where we're challenged that the ego feels it has to defend itself, and then we come out fighting instead of being ready to say, what does the Lord want?
You know, that phrase, divine self-love. Mm. So when you give up ego consciously, then you can. Yeah. You don't have to go through the pain.
Anyway, what they feel, the beings there, is a communality of the Absolute. They feel connected and one because they are all contained, consciously contained. In our other problem is unconsciousness. It's the characteristic of earth nature, is unconsciousness and ignorance. But there, all nature was a conscious